The woman sauntered into the tavern and sat down on a stool in front of the piano. She rolled up her sleeves, revealing a liver spot tattoo the size of Shamu the whale. And that was her second most prominent feature. She studied the keyboard as if it was the final exam for a college podiatry course she had no recollection of ever taking, although the lowermost octave did seem to resemble a cutaway diagram of a bunion she had once seen. The candy corn wired to the music rack likewise recalled her art major roommate's hilarious send-up of the callus exhibit in the medical school's commissary. Unbidden, the barkeep, a former chess master with a checkered past, sidled up to her and poured her a planter's wart punch. The woman took a belt, tightened it, and began to play. From a slow, unassuming chimney blues, there erupted abruptly a mad Macarena. That took the place by storm and drink. Her hands danced wildly over the keys, creating wormholes in the continuous fabric of the tavern's space-time musicum. She played the kind of tune that makes a man weep, assuming he just rinsed his eyes with naphtha. The music sizzled through the smoky room like an electrocutioner's jumper cable, causing most of the still conscious patrons to wish for three hands, one to nurse the beverage, and the other two to fend off invisible cannibals. Meanwhile, in a small, unstable office two flights upstairs, Bino Benghazi was also weeping. But for a different reason.
He always wept for a different reason.
He was sitting upright in an armored chair, his back tied behind his hands. In front of him floated Trowler the Trencherman.
Yes. Well done, well said.
In front of him floated Trowler the Trencherman. His rationality challenged would-be client, whom he all too often traded dimensional instability with. Bino had been preparing for a shamanic ritual involving virgin fog dogs. His uttering of dark, lemurical incantations had already summoned the essence of his ancestral warrior, Weasel Slayer.
Weasel Slayer.
The way the burning of six-year-old business receipts summons IRS bagmen keen on auditing. He had placed the fog dogs on a make-do altar, comprised of a pile of ledger demand orders on his desk, and had just intoned the verse, "There once was an orange flambeau," when the piano playing suddenly took a turn for the lunatic. And Trowler simultaneously materialized, and with his arrival, reality, not surprisingly, changed. Whereas in past encounters, Trowler had quickly lapsed into gibberish, this time he didn't say a word. That is, he didn't speak anything, since he had left his vocal cords elsewhere. Instead, he produced curiously lilting sounds by vibrating cilia on the inside of his chin horn. But even with his knack of hearing what others didn't want him to hear, Bino couldn't comprehend the Trencherman. The racket from the piano playing beneath him simply demanded too much of his senses. So, skipping to step 8 of his in-progress ritual,
step 8,
he instructed Trowler to shellac his lips shut,
shellac your lips shut,
wrap the trailer from an 8mm print of Battleship Potemkin around his eyes,
wrap the trailer,
plug his ears with lime anechoic gelatin,
plug ear,
and infuse his nostrils with a napalm fizz.
Infuse.
It was enough to give an otorhinolaryng...
You practiced that, didn't you?
I know.
You practiced that otorhinolaryngologist. Yes.
Double hearinging. However, properly...
You want to say that again? That was too good to miss.
It was enough to give an otorhinolaryngologist double hearinging. However, properly... properly deprived of his senses, Bino could now get the gist of what his visitor wanted. And it didn't especially make sense. While the manifestation which harangued Bino in his office struggled, as always, with dimensional reality, scraps of anti-trencher matter were enjoying an out-of-body experience 150 feet above the known universe. As Bino listened to the present Trowler, keen his plight in parallel fits, an anti-Bino entity slowly...
Anti-Bino! Wow! Wow!
So... I'm losing my train as well, anyway. Slowly coalesced in front of him. Unbidden, a different barkeep opened the door and sidled into the room. He pulled a shoebox from a voluminous apron pocket and placed it in front of the anti-Bino. The dopal shaman flicked off the lid and extracted a pair of rocket shoes. He laced them up, and as the music below entered the frantic stages of the coda, took off like an atomic ferret through a basketful of peat. Bang! Came the final crashing chord in a mode better left to the imagination. At the same time, the Trowler image winked out of existence. The fog dogs absquatulated into the dark office recesses, the barkeep left by another, likewise unbidden door, and Bino's office returned to the kind of irrational stability that only an abiding faith in Weasel Slayer could maintain. As he undid his bindings, Bino once again questioned, what was that? Was that the sound of a Bino binding? Bino once again questioned his species-neutral attitude towards his clientele. Was there no limit to what he'd do for a couple of bucks?
None. None whatsoever.
We do know this scene.
Right. We do know Bino.
Bino pulled... yep. Pulled on his yak boots and clodhopper down the stairs, just as the last notes were being sucked into the ceiling fan's anti-clockwise air wash. He strode to the bar and asked the apprentice mixologist who'd been playing the piano. With a gesture that seemed to encompass this and several parallel universes, the man shrugged his shoulders and pointed to a stain on the far tavern wall. It looked like a liver spot, except that it was the size of Shamu the whale. Bino sniffed at it and was immediately struck by the aroma of naphtha. What was that?
Being struck.
Attention.
Yeah, there's little boxes and sound effects things here.
He was struck rather hard, not to mention it. And by the time he came to, the bar was empty, save for the four image of this 193rd episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, which is at times as ephemeral as Bino's fog dogs, while at other times seems to go on and on. Until finally put out of its misery by Calvus.
I'm so good at putting things out of their misery. Today is one of those days.
What misery do we have to have looked forward to instead?
I think perhaps this particular arrangement for keyboard.
Oh, well.
But we'll describe further what this is in about 2 minutes when it's done. Out of our misery, here we go. Thank you. joint composition there.
Yes, by whom?
Music
and who?
Jointly composed by Charles Bester and Drew Krause and Greg Steinke.
Oh, good for them.
Yes, and you have heard Charles Bester's Stations of the Night, three blues for S, 9:15, midnight, and 3:45 a.m., Drew Krause's three intermezzi, Andante con moto, presto and grazioso, and Greg Steinke's family portrait, Dad's Tune, music for Carl Asa, Mom's Delight, lullaby for Kyle Albin, and Clara Dog Ramble.
Wow.
Wow.
And they say we don't bend the rules here at the bazaar.
That's right.
Your
red alert for new music.
Well, there we have it. Today, your red alert, we'll be giving you a little bit of light gray. We have the continuation of our interview with John McGuire. John was hungry when he was interviewed by us, so because he hadn't yet been fed, his enthusiasm was not yet engaged.
Right.
But
right.
It was fun nevertheless. So we'll hear that in about 17 minutes, and we have new releases for the rest of today.
Oh, what a relief.
Mostly unpreviewed new releases.
Well,
I mean previewed by their descriptions, but nothing much more than that. We'll listen to a couple of pieces. We'll start out with this one, which just happens to be 17 minutes long. It just fits into the time slot, and of course that's the only part, anything that's important.
That's it.
What fits. So this is a brand new CD from Lior Navok, a Boston composer, and this is something which apparently got good reviews.
I see on the cover, though, the image of a harp and, what was that other item, a rebec?
Well, here, let me just take it out of the
package. Oh, there's a saxophone,
package
too.
Here. This is Voices from India, string quartet number one from 1997, and the only problem with it is it's not cued with numbers. It's the last three sections of this CD, so I guess we'll do. This is the Christina Day, Anna Bard, Eric Pickow, and Erica Wise playing Lior Navok's string quartet number one.
Thank you.
Well, pretty good as Keen tunes go.
Sure is.
Yeah, Lior Navak's String Quartet No. 1, Voices from India. I like that little quote in there from Ancient Voices of Children that just sort of slipped in.
I thought you were going to say that you liked the little upbeat snorting, which...
I did. You know, my violin teacher, Joseph Kovach, used to do that all the time. His whole idea of phrasing was to make sure that he gave a good snort before an upbeat. Got distracted after a while as he explained phrasing with the up bow plus snort. I think, who also did that? Actually,
a member of the
Casals
did yes, that. Yes, yes. As a member of the Vermont Contemporary Music Ensemble.
Ah, well, my favorite moment when Casals did that. But, oh, by the way, this is the Calvus and Damian New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield and on the internet. And gosh, it's the top of the hour. We got to do this interview, but I'm just reminded of this wonderful recording when Casals was conducting. It was out on, I guess, Columbia, of him conducting a Mozart Eine kleine Nachtmusik. And you know, it has a great phrasing in the second movement. And of course, when he's conducting, he's in front of this, he's going, wah, wah, wah. And he's humming at the same time, and the microphones carefully catch all of this. And a wonderful moment in the last movement where he just sort of belts out a great sort of, I don't know what kind of a sound it was. It was a bleat of some kind. Ah, yes. Whatever happened to the Romantic era? Well, here it is, right on Lior Navak's new CD, Navak's new CD, Hidden Reflections. That is on the NLP label. We'll have it up on our website if I ever get to doing playlists again. So how about we go to that, the sound of the music of John McGuire.
Yes, do you want to put us back into... Ah, there. I'm feeling McGuired again.
Yes, he... after 32 years in Germany, he's back in America, in New York City. He did say...
he came back just in time to hit 70 home runs, too. That's quite timely.
Yes, how about that? And he did say he was feeling a bit lonely in the city, working for Carl Fischer, doing 19th century score sales.
Ah, good.
So let's listen to some of his music and then go on to the interview. We'll be back in some time.
You started to tell us about, to tell me about how you met Henning Berg. And he was a guest on our show a couple of years ago, and I said, well, did you play with him? And he said, no, he was more of a jazz musician. I asked you about his pet project there for a long time, Tango, that interactive feature.
Well, the way we met was that the Studio for Electronic Music of the West German Radio was for several years in the same building that the West German Radio Big Band rehearsed in. And I was doing a piece in the studio, and Henning was interested in what was going on in the studio. He was in the Big Band, and during the breaks that the Big Band took, he would come up to the studio, and that way we got to know each other. Through a common interest in electronic music.
Right. Hmm. Tell me about your electronic music and how you worked on it there, what materials you used.
Well, I started working on electronic music in actually started kind of getting serious about it in the early 70s in a small private studio in Cologne called the Feedback Studio.
Oh, yeah.
They had a small synthesizer, which I spent hundreds of hours improvising on, kind of getting a feel for. And I was that went on over a period of years, actually, until around the middle 70s. But I was unable to really get interested enough, or let's say not interested enough to get the kind of interest or the kind of angle into a piece from the synthesizer improvisations, which kind of branched off from my composing into a hobby. I was interested in bringing that back, bringing the composing and the work with electronics together at some point, but I couldn't figure out how these just seemed to have not that much to do with each other. Until one day, I just took this, I did something very simple, just as an experiment. I took a, turned off everything, all the various things that were influencing other things on the synthesizer, and I had these pins plugged in, and just recorded onto a tape machine some sine tones in harmonic relationships and made a loop out of it that went very fast, and listened to that for a while, and thought to myself, well, this is much more interesting than all these improvisations I've been doing for years. It was like cleaning out my head. And I thought, maybe this is a way to start an electronic music. So I start the first piece I did, I got into a proper studio where I could do lots, where they had lots of big machines and everything was Dolbyized, and there was a 16-track Dolby tape recorder and a big mixer at the Cologne Hochschule for Musik. And I did my first real piece there, which was consisted of pitches, basically sine tone mixtures. Deliberate reference to early 50s Cologne electronic music, sine tone mixtures. But these were harmonic mixtures.
What do you mean by harmonic mixtures?
Well, they were fifths and fourths and octaves.
Okay.
Not weird relationships or scales, but very, very kinds of simple intervals that I worked with in my first simple intervals and sine tones, but built up in as many layers as I could think of.
Okay.
That was the first electronic piece I did, and that was at the called Pulse Music One. It was done at the Musikhochschule in Cologne. And that was how I got then into electronic music, was over that studio for that piece. Was there somewhere else this question was?
No, I was just curious as to, at that time, what developments you were working on in electronics.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to lead to a question, which I might as well ask now, is what's your opinion of the work that's being done in electronics today, and are you still working in electronics?
Well, I did a piece last year. Was the third piece, an electronic piece I'd done at the Studio for Electronic Music at the West German Radio.
Yeah.
It was shortly after I did Pulse Music 1 at the Hochschule. A couple of years later, I was asked to come over to the West German Radio to their Studio for Electronic Music, and there I did my second electronic piece, which was called Pulse Music 3. Because Pulse Music 2 came in the middle and was a piece for orchestra. And over the next 20 years, I think I did six commissions for the West German Radio, but three of them were electronic pieces.
Okay.
I got to work in the studio for electronic pieces.
So, where have you gone with your electronics? And to return to that other question of what do you think about what's going on in electronics today? And shall I throw into that mix your opinion of MIDI and the the sort of popularization of electronic instruments?
That's a whole bunch of questions. Let's see, which was the first one? I lost track.
You today. Here we go. The two words. You today, others today, MIDI. There we go.
Keep it simple. Me today is not working on electronic music. I did my last piece in 1997. That was a piece for my wife, who's a singer, and her own vocal samples. So I had come from working with sine tones to vocal samples, which was quite a big difference between those, but you might say there's certain similarities over all the years that I worked with electronic music in very harmonic intervals, which is what I started with and what I ended up with sample voice at the end, because I wanted to write a piece for my wife, who's a singer. So the last piece I did was called A Cappella, and it's for solo soprano and her own samples and nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an opportunity to hear that?
Yeah, I do. I have a tape of that.
Great. Let's hear that now. And we'll come back and I'll ask you that question again about what you think about the direction others are taking in electronic music and the popularization of the MIDI instruments. Here it is, music by our guest, John McGuire. Thank you.
Thank you.
was a piece for vocal samples and voice. What the title of that again is?
Acapella.
Acapella. Yes, I should have remembered. So how about, what else is going on in electronic music these days?
I don't really know. I'm not, haven't been following the development of electronic music. Maybe you can tell that by listening to this video.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to the popularization of the electronic instruments through MIDI. You're sort of feeling, do you have any gut feelings about that or any kind of reactions?
Seems fine with me.
Okay. I ask only because there are some composers we've spoken to have felt a little usurped by that, and some have also felt that the use of 12 tone equal temperament that is encouraged by this has been destructive in some ways of progress in electronic music.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. But you don't necessarily have to use 12-tone equal temperament, do you?
You don't have to, but because it's
more expensive.
Kind of the default that everything comes with. In the old days of analog machines, you had to kind of tune everything to your taste, whereas now you get a very precise digital device that is ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And only the more sophisticated machines permit retuning.
Right. In other words, it's more expensive to get away from that.
Yeah. And takes, and it's difficult because the machines aren't set up to do that easily.
Mm-hmm. So.
What brought you back?
Quite a few things.
I should rephrase that because you've been in Germany for so long. I should say. What you brought you from home to here.
Yeah, you could almost say that. There are quite a few things. It's almost too personal a question.
Well, all right, I mean, we can skip it. I just thought there might be some career opportunity opened up here that made it one of those impossible to refuse things.
No, I had no such
okay.
opportunity.
Okay.
There was a reason that I should tell you. I could tell you off the tape, and then you at
Fine.
Least know.
Fine enough. We'll do that at some point.
Okay.
Not for now. Let's go to kind of your philosophy of where music is going. I mean, you're one. Everybody's one composer. I always ask this question, and I get that kind of raised eyebrow look, like me philosophy. but you know, you can't work for so many years without having developed some sort of clear vision of what you want to do as a composer that is mostly spoken by your music, but still there are other aspects of what you do and why you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And what might yours be?
Well, that's very different than wanting to know where music in general is going.
That we'll get there. I still want to sort of push you over that edge.
I don't know if I can be pushed. Yeah, I suppose I have enough outstanding projects to keep me going for enough lifetimes. But that all boils down to a kind of dicking around with very specific kinds of compositional problems that I see cropping up. Every piece just throws up new problems that seem to push themselves into the foreground of my attention before I ever get around to any kind of general philosophical basis for what it is that I want to do. I see these specific compositional problems grasping my lapels and demanding my attention.
Well, so even the idea that it's a compositional problem as opposed to, say, an entertainment, that some other composers have said. They write music strictly to be pleasure upon the ear. Interestingly, very often those who wrestle with it as a compositional problem and those who write it as entertainment sometimes come up with pieces that are very similar. So why the notion of the compositional problem?
Well, I would think that writing something that's just purely a pleasure for the ears is also a big problem. You might well write something that doesn't give your ears any pleasure at all, and you've got a problem. So I'm saying problem in a very kind of generalized way.
All right. What couple of examples? You've already described one of the compositional problems you addressed. Some of the others, just a few, so that our listeners can understand what that means. Mm-hmm. Because for someone who listens to music and is not in the process of making it themselves, the notion of it being a problem is somehow sounds like something that should be out in the scientific world, perhaps not in the artistic one. Mm-hmm. What is that? What is a composition problem?
Well, there are all kinds. The last piece I had a couple, for example, just to give you a specific example from the last couple I worked on, one of which was to find a way of using my wife's voice. Being aware as I was that if I could write a piece for my wife, she would then get paid. So one of the problems was how to get my wife paid for my work. there were sub aspects to this problem, or you might put it the other way around, if that was a sub aspect to the problem of somebody who had been working for so long on music that had sound sources that had strong, sharp taxing, like piano music, percussion stuff that I've written, or electronic percussion kinds of sounds. How would I write a piece for voice? A voice doesn't have any such kind of attack form, but the attack form is going to influence the form and the rhythm and the texture that you use. What do you do when you have suddenly a totally different kind of attack? How is that going to influence the form and the kinds of sequences that you compose? It turns out it's going to influence it profoundly, of course, and you have to somehow react sensitively to that new given that you've given yourself. Mm-hmm. You find yourself confronted with a whole new problem. So there's an example of maybe slightly less frivolously formulated.
Okay, yeah, no, that's good. I think that's very helpful because I think to hear the difference between how a voice works and how a piano works is a very clear distinction that you've made for us that it would certainly ask you to recast your entire way of working. And it seems like that is a long-term sort of thing from you. Again, I'm guessing, but it sounds like it takes you a lot of time and energy and effort to create each piece.
Yeah.
You don't sort of cast them out like rice.
Yeah, you could say that. I've worked for several years on a number of my pieces.
Happy with them when they're done?
In general, pretty so-so. I'm usually so tired of them that I just as soon not think about them anymore.
Something that I mentioned off mic earlier about the generation of composers younger than you and I are. Have sort of view many of the things we do as sort of historical artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see happening in composition? Do you listen? Do you pay attention to what's going on in other younger composers and their work?
Well, I'm very interested to do that again. I've been... you asked me a while ago why I came back to the States. One thing I'd like to do is have a little bit more contact. I was off there in the countryside in Germany, basically contemplating my navel for years and working on my problems. I don't really know what's going on very much these days or what younger composers are. I'm very interested to find out.
I was fascinated by one composer who said that when he was a student, he discovered these old records by this guy Stockhausen, and he was so excited because he had never heard of anything like that before. And it was kind of stopped me short in the interview because I realized that these old records of Stockhausen are what I listened to when I was quite young, and they were brand new, and I was thrilled. Uh-huh. So it was rather startling for me to realize that some of the composers we've spoken to view these as historical styles that they can incorporate, and they play them with a new sense of discovery when they play them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a stopper for me.
That's a stopper. Well, I was very interested to that. I was told when I was at the electronic music studio at the West German Radio, they'd invited a young composer there who was fascinated to find this thing there called a synthesizer,
yeah,
where he could actually twiddle the dials and the joystick. He'd practically grown up with a computer keyboard.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Looking at a monitor. This was a discovery for him. Very enthusiastic.
The accident on the analog.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, yeah. I still have my old analog machine as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, although it's packed away right now, it's certainly a temptation to bring it back out again. To see what discoveries I can make having spent 15 years in the digital realm.
Mm.
You know, working with things that I had to specify with great care.
Mm.
I did enjoy some of that. The forms and shapes that were so easy to create when you worked in the analog thing.
Mm.
Where are you going next with your own music? Do you have something in the works right now?
I'm kind of wondering that myself. I don't really know. I think I'd like to stick with the working on these same problems with the voice. I found it very exciting to take something that was so complex as a given. I found that an utterly different kind of thing than working from atoms outward, as I had in the case of the electronic pieces with the sine tones, and taking that basically same attitude toward the piano,
mm-hmm,
and even toward musical instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, when I confronted myself with the voice, that was really no longer possible. It turned out that every sound was a world.
Yes.
And so it just had to be approached from the opposite direction. And I found that challenging and also it was something that just appealed to me. Something that appealed to my heart, let's say. And so I'd like to stick with working with the voice for a while longer, see where that goes.
To ask you some of the crass American questions.
Some of the crass American questions?
Who's your audience?
Hmm?
Who's your audience?
Oh, at the moment, I don't have an audience that I know of.
Who do you write for? Let me couch that in sort of the reason I asked the question,
mm-hmm,
which is, it is possible to imagine and work out a composition without ever setting it down, either electronically or on paper.
It is?
yeah.
You mean keeping it all in your head?
Yeah. Or even if you discard pieces and bits of it as you go along, you can solve those sorts of problems that you talked about without keeping it. If you keep it, if you finish it, it implies most of the time, trying to do my lawyerly best here, it implies most of the time that there is meant to be a listener outside the composer.
Mm-hmm.
Who is that listener? Who's your imagined listener, your imagined audience?
Well, that's a very complicated question. As somebody who most of the years of living in Europe, I felt like an exile. I got used to the idea of actually not having an audience that was actually not having any audience much outside of myself. I was basically my audience. I kept my sanity, or thought I was trying to keep my sanity during this time by telling myself that this was okay, because I'm not that different from everybody else, and if it's something that interests me, then there are bound to be other people out there who are interested in this too. So it's not really an issue for me. This was the way I talked to myself at that time. I'm not sure I'm going to go on talking this way. So I really don't know what my audience is. Now I feel like I'm almost doubly exiled. I don't know really where I am right now, but in terms of audience, or in terms of performance. So.
Well, you at least have one now. We often call our the recipient of our broadcast our audience, because sometimes we suspect it goes down to perhaps one. But let's hear one more piece, and then we'll come back for a final question.
Okay.
Music by John McGuire. Thank you.
is part of our goal here on the show.
This is part of the torture you put your guests through.
John McGuire, one of our good friends, composer Joel Shadaby, once asked me to ask composers this question, and I found it so fascinating that I can't resist asking. So my question to you is, what do you consider your pioneering act as a composer?
Well, that's really much too hard a question. I don't think I can answer that. I think that's a question that if one has made any kind of pioneering contribution, it's up to others to name it. That just makes me feel too self-conscious. I just can't do it, Dennis. I remember reading in a program for the performance, or I think the first performance of Stockhausen's series, which as we know is not exactly a modest one, that it's dedicated to the American pioneers on Earth and in space. This is a man who obviously identifies too with pioneers, but he's not calling himself one. Not even he does that.
Well, you're asking that's me? That's why I asked the question. That's why we ask the questions here. we have yet to ask him that question, actually. We had hoped to be able to sit down with him and interview him one of his associates and try to set it up, but the timing just didn't work out. So maybe the next time we'll be able to ask him that question. But I bet he won't deny it.
I'm sure he won't. Well, good luck to you.
Well, this has been fun. This has been a great pleasure. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to have met you.
Too.
And I'm glad you're here in the States because we can get together again. Mm-hmm. So thank you, John McGuire, for joining us. I was in Dayton Community this week.
Well, it's been nice to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield. And that was the conclusion of 48 Variations for Two Pianos by John McGuire.
And we'll be revisiting this interview down the road for those of you who didn't get all of it.
Well, there is that question of the questions he didn't answer, so I think we'll have to go back and ask him more, do you think?
Who will go back and ask him more?
You'll have your turn. John McGuire. Did I mention last week, two things. One, I did mention that wind that was blowing through that 35th floor room at the ever-so-quiet Marriott in Times Square. And the other thing was that he looks just like Dennis Murphy.
Right, yes. So you
just like him. Sounds like him in many ways in his tone of voice. Looks double for him. Absolutely incredible. John McGuire, our guest today on The Bazaar. How about a change of tone?
What on earth could you possibly dig up that would change the tone?
Well, one of our favorites, Violeta Dinescu, has sent us her brand new CD on a new series called The European Music Project. This is Vortex Vulcan 3 from 1998. There are three Vortex Vulcans. This is number 3. A little different, yes. Yeah.
What is the... do we have electronics, or what do we have
this
here?
This is orchestra.
Ooh, good.
This is, yes, with non-electronic, non-open fifth, non-tonal, non-gentle, dynamically expressive, loud and soft elements.
Oh, I think I'm ready.
Here it is, music by Violeta Dinescu.
And the crowd are loving it.
From the European Music Project, that was Vulcan 3 by Violeta Dinescu. I'm going to play those other two, I think.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I got to listen to them. These are all new releases. We've just gotten these, and we haven't had a chance to preview them, but based on our red alert understanding, we know what to play. Here's one, also brand new release. We've been waiting for this one for a while. Susie Allen said Susan Allen on the CD now, but she kept emailing and saying Susie Allen. And Vinnie Golia, which says Vinnie, not Vincent, on the CD, as opposed to Susie, who says Susan, put out a CD called Duets. Just arrived. This has been a long time coming. We've been waiting for it. And here is the final cut on that, 14, called 4MP.
Duets, Susan, duets for?
Harp.
Uh-huh.
And Vinnie, who plays lots of things, clarinets and saxes and bassoons and all sorts of other stuff. So in this particular cut, I believe he plays some clarinet material, as I recall. Here it is, for MP with Susan Allen and Vinnie Golia.
Mm-hmm.
taking another breath there. I heard it. He was ready to launch into a reprise. Vinnie Golia and Susan Allen on, sound like bass clarinet there, and harp.
Harp music on
harp.
On the bazaar.
I know, that's very unusual.
It is, but well worth a listen.
It gives me a little shudder, but there it was. I'll listen to the rest of the CD and see if we can play some more. Oh, that's from Duets. That's on Nine Winds Recordings. You got something there.
Oh, yeah. This was something that you laid on me last week. It's John Luffink, whom I think sent this to us unbidden, or had you...
Yeah, oh, yes, always unbidden.
And this is Avant-Garde Analog Synthesizer Excursions, and what a treat to listen to analog. I mean, I know you're...
But Avant-Garde Analog from when?
Oh, right, from 15 months ago, 14 months ago, not long ago, but
no.
This is called...
Wait. Recorded when?
Oh, 1985.
Ah, better.
All right.
Better.
Yes, in Florida.
In Florida, of course.
So that makes a difference. This is,
it does.
This is Cetacea from Pre and Post History, music for analog synthesizer. I like that. That's Shamu the Space Whale from pre- and post-history. Cetacea. Avant-garde analog synthesizer excursions by John Luffink.
That was good.
It was fun. I felt right back in the early 80s, that's for sure.
Well, let's keep going. Here's a Bill Sitharis duet for Morphine and Cymbal. Morphine, Crystal Resonances, and Cymbal Timbres. This is from this wonderful new CD, Tuning at eartha.mills.edu. We're coming up close on time, so let's get right to the Sitharis, and we'll come back with some others. Here's one now.
Thank you.
Oh, nice.
Oh, those Mills boys have it together this time.
The Mills brothers, what?
Yes, the Mills brothers have it together this time.
From eartha.mills.edu, microtonal tuning experience. Okay, we're going to wrap it up. We're coming up close. Susan Allen and Vinny Galea again. I understand Vinny Galea was here in Montpelier twice in at the Peerless, at the good old Peerless. So here we are, duet number 12, and then we're going to wrap it up with John Starrett's Limp Off to School in 19-tone equal temperament.
Excellent.
That's Calvis and Damien for this week. Here's Vinny and Susan.
Thank you. A production of Multimedia.